Jason tugged his bow tie into shape in front of a large standing mirror.
"That's an unusual outfit," Gary said. "A bit more snug than I like. I think the locals have it right, fashion-wise."
They were in the lounge room of the suite shared by Rufus, Gary, and Farah. Gary wore evening wear that showed off all the colourful drapery favoured by Greenstone High Society. "I had Gilbert make it up," Jason said. "It's called a tuxedo." Jason enjoyed the hang of a well-tailored suit, but he found himself missing his armor. He had been wearing it almost constantly, through battles and danger, until it felt like a part of him. Still, a night at the symphony involved neither battles nor danger, so perhaps it was best to feel a little different. And even if it did, his tuxedo had some strengthening treatments and a few enchantment tricks to facilitate a quick escape, if necessary.
"Not enough colours," Gary said, still eyeing off Jason's clothes.
"I like it," Farah said, emerging from her own room. "Simple and elegant."
"Why does Rufus always take the longest to get ready?" Gary asked. "He doesn't even have hair. I'm ready. I'm pretty much all hair."
"I remember not having hair," Jason said. "Didn't care for it." "It's nice to be going out again," Farah said. Jason moved so she could take his place to check her outfit in the mirror.
"Agreed," Jason said. "The program was in three parts, right? A nice long evening at the symphony will be just the thing, I think."
"Danielle said she invited us because she thought you would enjoy it," Farah said. "She knows you've been working hard."
"I ran into Humphrey out in the Delta yesterday," Jason said. "We did a job off a notice board together."
"How was that?" Farah asked.
"Well, I stood there while he killed the monster immediately, so straightforward."
"Everyone's ready?" Rufus asked, stepping out of his room.
"Of course we're ready," Farah said. "You're always the last one out."
"Did you wax your head?"
Gary asked Rufus.
"No," Rufus said. "I did not wax my head."
"Really?"
Gary asked.
"Because it looks like you waxed your head."
"There is something of a sheen to it," Jason observed. "Maybe I rubbed in a little moisturizing treatment," Rufus admitted.
"You did," Gary said. "You waxed your head."
"I did not wax my head."
"I think it looks nice," Farah said. "Very shiny."
Unlike the theater district, which was located in Old City, the Grand Concert Hall was very close to their lodgings in the Guild District. They walked the short distance through the wide streets, the sun low but still hanging in the summer sky. The concert hall was a magnificent, circular building that Jason walked past every day on his way to the Adventure Society campus. With two lengthy intermissions scheduled, Jason intended to take a look around between performances. They joined Danielle Geller and her son Humphrey in their private box. When the first interval arrived, the rest of the group headed in the direction of the drinking lounge, restricted to private box holders. As they left, Danielle discreetly stopped Jason.
"I have a friend I would like you to meet,"
she said quietly, handing him a piece of paper.
"I said you would find her during the first intermission. You won't make a liar of me, will you?"
"You aren't pushing me into a box, are you, Lady Geller?"
"I wouldn't dare," she said with a sly smile.
As Danielle left him behind, Jason glanced at the piece of paper. It listed directions to a room on the second floor, one down from Geller's third-floor private box. Walking through the hallways was like walking through an art gallery, with paintings and recessed sculptures carefully lit with delicate magical lighting. He found the room listed on the paper, where a plaque declared it the Edith Vane Memorial Conference Room. He frowned at the name. There was one aura that he could sense within, with the overpowering strength of silver rank. He considered knocking, but just went in instead. The conference room looked like just that, with a long table surrounded by chairs. Soft lamps hung from the ceiling, filling the room with a warm light. Along one wall, windows looked out over the city. The Guild District was mostly low buildings, with the Adventure and Magic Society campuses looming large, along with the concert hall itself. The sun had set during the first performance, and street lamps lit thoroughfares below, lighting up the bustling nightlife. The room's single occupant had her back to him as he looked out over the city. She wore a formal dress in the local style, a loose draping of layered colours, cinched with flattering strategy. Chestnut hair spilled down her back, with a pair of tapered ears poking out to reveal her as an elf. Jason couldn't have hidden his presence if he wanted to, but she gave no reaction to his entrance at all. Jason took a bottle and a glass from his inventory, pouring out a measure of sweet green liqueur. "Drink?" he offered. She held out a hand without turning around. The glass tugged itself from Jason's grip and flew across the room into hers, without so much as spilling a drop.
"Thank you," she said, and took a sip. "This is one of Mr. Norwich's private concoctions. He's a friend of a friend, yes?"
"He is," Jason said. Norwich was an alchemist friend of Jory's, who had been trying to brew a drink that would get through Jason's poison resistance. Norwich didn't want to turn to bronze rank ingredients, partly as a challenge and partly to prevent a bronze rank hangover. Jason took out another glass and poured a drink for himself, then wandered over to stand next to the woman. He looked out at the city instead of at her.
"Do you know who I am, Mr. Asano?"
"I only really know the one elf. We don't get along."
"The Priestess of Purity?"
"That's the one," Jason said. "Very severe woman, powerful, Aryan vibe, sexy, but you know you really shouldn't, like an evil lady torturer."
"You think speaking a little nonsense is going to put me off kilter?"
"You think bringing me to a room named after a family I killed half of will do the same to me?" She turned to look at him, then back to the window.
41 contracts in 18 days, if we count adventure board notices," she said. "You've been a busy man."
"It feels like I have a lot of catching up to do."
"Can you keep this pace up?"
"Not unless someone makes me a magical scooter."
"Is that some manner of transport from your world?"
"It is," Jason said. "I think it would be nice, riding along the embankment roads, the wind in my face."
"I did hear about your distaste for Heidels. Quite unusual for an adventurer."
"Eccentricity is the prerogative of the wealthy and powerful. I barely qualify for either, but I'm working on it."
"Then you should make more lucrative investments than in a man who has dedicated his life to healing the poor."
"I'll muddle through," Jason said. "Did you want anything more than to point out how much attention you're paying, Director? This intermission won't last forever." Elspeth Arella was director of the Greenstone branch of the Adventure Society. Rufus had pointed her out, along with any number of other local notables, during their spate of social outings the month previous.
"You'll find, Mr. Asano, that these intermissions last as long as certain people want them to."
"I see."
"I'm satisfied with how you have been conducting yourself since joining the Adventure Society."
"Awakening Stone satisfied?"
"I would not take your self-satisfaction as a reasonable measure of mine, Mr. Asano. I especially do not care for some mid-level magic society functionary contacting my office to request a meeting with a member of my society, one not even a month clear of assessment."
"Couldn't they just come and find me directly?" Jason asked innocently. She turned to give him a withering glare, her aura crushing his into the floor. He nonchalantly sipped at his drink, still looking out the window.
"Take a break from contracts for a little while, Mr. Asano. You've been clearing out the backlog I used to prod some of our members who don't share your work ethic. I will see you are assigned appropriate contracts. Just check the desk at the jobs hall. If you do well, you can expect to see a second star in the near future."
"You're the boss," Jason said.
"You don't strike me as a man who pays much heed to authority."
"I'm not big on abdicating moral responsibility." She drained the glass and handed it back to him.
"You have a taste for the sweet things, Mr. Asano. You drink like an elf."
"You can knock back the plonk pretty well," Jason said. "You drink like an Aussie."
"I have no idea what an Aussie is."
"I am, Director. I am."
"A friend of yours?"
Jason whispered to Danielle as he took a seat back in the viewing box.
"A new friend," Danielle said, "but I think a good one."
The art-lined public corridors of the concert hall worked their way around the circular building. There were plenty of concertgoers taking in the art during the second intermission, Jason included. Drink in hand, he meandered down a hallway, alone. He stopped to consider a painting of a barren desert wasteland. It was impressionistic in style, reminding Jason of his earliest days in his new world. A woman joined him in examining it. He spared her a glance before turning back to the picture. He sensed no aura from her at all. His aura senses weren't the sharpest, but to hide it completely meant she was probably higher rank than he was. She looked to be in her early 20s, by which point any decent adventurer hit bronze rank. Not many got a late start like Jason. She had the olive skin of a local, her delicate features an effortless, dangerous beauty. Dark hair cascaded over her shoulders to a gown that was elegance in cream silk.
Mediocre, the woman critiqued the painting in front of them. They hang the superior works in the restricted lounges.
I like it, Jason said. It looks how the desert feels.
You've spent some time there?
A little. It reminds me of parts of my homeland.
And where is that?
Very far from here, he said, wistfully. She turned her head towards him.
You're Jason Asano.
Jason kept his eyes on the painting. I'm not sure you understand how introductions work, he said. I already know who I am. She frowned, and he felt a bronze rank aura blaze out to suppress his own. He had been told that was the very height of rudeness, but he kept being subjected to it. He thought there might be a lesson there, but he had no interest in learning it. Absently, he wondered if he was becoming a masochist. A beautiful woman invading my personal space, he said, unconcerned. Should I be scared or delighted? The corners of his mouth turned up in a sly smile. Perhaps, he mused, the most delicious choice would be both.
Do you want to get slapped?
The woman asked him. He turned his head to face her. Would you think less of me if I said yes? She arched an eyebrow.
My name is Cassandra Mercer.
Ah, Jason said, turning back to the painting. Now I see.
See what?
Everything.
Oh, really?
If Thadwick had sent you, Jason said, then this would be an alley and you would be much less pretty. I imagine you were here at your mother's behest. You strike me as someone very good at satiating urges of curiosity.
If I struck you, Mr. Asano, you'd know all about it. And speaking of my mother, I've heard you said some unkind things in her regard.
Jason turned again from the painting to give her a sheepish smile. For that, he said, please convey my unreserved apologies. I didn't know who your brother was at the time, and he actually asked me if I knew who his father was. You don't walk away from a line like that.
A man of dignity would?
Jason let out a sinister chuckle.
Yes, I imagine one would. I did make some discreet inquiries about you, Cassandra acknowledged. There was enticingly little to find. You have me at a disadvantage.
Jason raised his eyebrows at that claim. Miss Mercer, you have power, influence, connections, wealth, and knowledge. What possible advantage could I have over you?
Mystery, she said. Isn't that the greatest advantage?
Mystery is an illusory shield, Jason said. The moment the veil is pierced, your vulnerabilities become exposed, and there is only one arena in which vulnerability becomes a weapon.
And what arena is that?
His face showed disappointment. It's truly a shame you have to ask, he said. If you'll excuse me, I believe the intermission will end soon. He left without looking back. She watched him walk away, a contemplative expression on her face. She left in the other direction. In their family's private booth, Cassandra sat down next to her mother. Thalia Mercer looked more like her daughter's sister than her parent, the age-defying power of her silver rank essences.
Well?
Thalia asked.
He's dangerous, Cassandra said. Don't let Thadwick anywhere near him.
Thadwick isn't the problem, Thalia said. The problem is how much trouble your father will cause to salve your brother's pride. You know how he is about his male heir.
That could be a concern, given Asano's connection to Rufus Remore, Cassandra said. Have you found out any more about his background?
I have confirmed that Remore is training him, Thalia said, with no small amount of dedication. As for where Asano came from, it's like he fell out of the sky.
I've heard something else, Cassandra said. I wasn't going to say anything until I confirmed it.
Oh?
You'll recall that Remore and his companions undertook an expedition out of the city.
The vein problem, Thalia said.
I always disliked Cressida.
They went at the behest of the Church of Purity, took one of the church's healers along with them, a girl from the LaSalle family.
You know her?
I do. Anissa. Zealous girl, dangerously committed.
What does she have to say?
I can't approach her directly, Cassandra said. She thinks I comport myself in a sinful manner.
I should hope so, Thalia said. That's where all the fun is.
What I'm hearing from my sources in the Church of Purity, Cassandra said, is that Anissa left Remore's group after some stranger with dark powers joined them.
Interesting, Thalia said. That fits with something I heard about Remore, believing he bungled the contract, that he would have failed if not for the intervention of someone else.
I heard much the same, Cassandra said.
But how could that be Asano?
I've already confirmed that he came to the city with no skills at all. Remore and his companions trained Asano for weeks just to get him to a minimum standard.
You said dark powers? Thalia said.
Asano is an affliction specialist. Certainly enough to put a priestess of purity right off, Cassandra said. But there are still incongruities. My instincts tell me there's more to this.
Trust your instincts, dear, Thalia said. Find out what you can.
Of course, steps have already been taken.
For the moment, Thalia said.
Is it worth you taking the time to beguile him?
It might be worth the effort, Cassandra said, but not worth the risk.
Oh?
Thalia prompted. He treated the full suppression of my aura like it was the pleasant cool of the evening.
That's certainly unusual, Thalia said. And you aren't normally so crude as to use your aura like that.
I was trying to throw him off balance, Cassandra said. But there's something strange about him. It's like he lives off balance. Talking to him feels like teetering on the edge of something I don't understand. Thalia glanced at her daughter from under an arched eyebrow.
What? Cassandra asked.
Nothing, dear,
Thalia said, turning her gaze to the stage, a slight smile playing across her lips. They sat in silence for a few moments before Cassandra spoke again.
Mother? Yes, dear?
When does vulnerability become a weapon?
Thalia chuckled, quietly, prompting an irritated look from Cassandra.
Vulnerability is a weapon of seduction, dear, Thalia said. Tricky to use, but devastating if wielded well. Perhaps Thadwick isn't the only one I should keep away from this young man.
Don't be ridiculous, Mother.
Chapter 66. A Stronger Weapon Than the One in Your Hand. Humphrey was returning to the family estate after completing a contract, muddy and spattered with monster blood. He was met by Phoebe, a distant cousin. Like him, she was Iron Rank, but joined the Adventure Society more than half a year earlier. The Geller family sprawled across continents. Although they shared a last name, Phoebe and Humphrey were barely related. They didn't even share an ethnicity, with her skin being darker and hair much lighter than Humphrey's. As was traditional for the Geller family, Phoebe had been sent to Greenstone for training and experience. Once she reached Bronze Rank, she would return to her homeland.
What is going on with that friend of yours?
Phoebe asked Humphrey.
You mean Jason? Humphrey asked.
I've been busy with contracts, so I haven't seen him. Mother said he was spending a lot of time in the Mirage Chamber.
A lot of time is right, Phoebe said. He's been in there almost all day every day, for most of a week, Phoebe said. He'll fight anyone who comes in, Bronze Rank, Iron Rank, he doesn't care. Your mother says it's good experience for our people to face an affliction specialist.
Is he winning? Humphrey asked.
Mostly he's losing,
she said sharply. People have a habit of dying after he's already been beaten, though. Those afflictions are nasty.
I've seen him kill monsters with them, Humphrey said. I'm not sure I would want to see that on a person.
I don't understand how he keeps going when he loses so much, Phoebe said. That would really get to me.
You learn more from a loss, Humphrey said. I wouldn't bother trying to understand Jason, though. I think Mother is the only one who sees through him.
He did manage a few unexpected victories, Phoebe said.
When the Mirage Chamber throws out a complicated environment, he gets tricky to deal with.
Oh? He beat my brother.
He beat Rick.
Rick is like you, she said. Put the enemy in front of him, and nothing at Iron Rank is going to survive. But the Mirage Arena put them in a ruined town, the post-surge, clean-out scenario, so monsters everywhere. He'd hit and run every time Rick was distracted.
The illusion power of the Mirage area could combine environments and enemies into many different scenarios. A post-surge clean-out was set in a town that had been overrun during a monster surge. It was a favorite of the Geller family trainers, due to the complex environment and constant threat of hidden monsters. Often it was used to train search and destroy missions, but it also made a dynamic arena for combat.
I'm guessing Rick asked for a rematch, Humphrey said. Straight away, Phoebe said. But your mother stepped in, took over, and decided to make a demonstration of it. She must have been watching.
I think Jason fascinates her, Humphrey said. She likes to take people apart like puzzles, to see how they work. Jason is nothing if not puzzling.
She put out a notice for everyone on site to assemble in the viewing room in...
She pulled out a pocket watch to check the time.
Just under 2 hours. Enough time for you to take a shower first. You smell like swamp and dead monster. Why didn't you use some crystal wash?
I ran out. It's been hard to get a hold of lately, Humphrey said.
Actually, I noticed that too.
The Mirage area viewing room was laid out like a lecture theatre, and Geller family trainers would often use it as such. With tiered seats looking down on a large viewing window, trainers could talk while Mirage arena images, live or recorded, were projected behind them. It was already half full when Humphrey arrived, with more people coming in behind him.
Your mother tweaked the rematch, Phoebe said as Humphrey took a seat next to her. This time, Rick will have his whole team.
All of them? Humphrey asked.
Who does Jason have with him?
No one, Phoebe said, although I suspect your mother's hand will be firmly pressed down on the scale.
Rick has Claire on his team. She'll just cleanse off all of Jason's afflictions.
Your mother set the conditions of the match. I'm not the one to complain to. I'm going to go find her, Humphrey said, standing up.
Sit back down,
Phoebe scolded, putting a restraining hand on his arm.
Do you honestly think you can change her mind?
Humphrey did as he was told and sat down.
I never have before.
I'm not exactly sure what the point is, Jason said. He was alone with Danielle Geller in the control room of the Mirage Arena. They were awaiting the arrival of Rick Geller and his team.
The point, Danielle said, is to learn. That's what we do here. We teach and we learn. My family has spread across the world, but this is the place we first became adventurers. It's where we still do.
I meant more specifically, Jason said. I'm not sure I can hold up against 5 of your family members long enough to make any kind of educational contribution.
When Rufus first described you to me, do you know what he said?
Rakishly handsome?
Danielle chuckled. He told me that when you were all prisoners, you showed him what it meant to find something inside yourself you didn't know was there, to do what didn't seem possible.
He may not have been paying attention, Jason said. Mostly I freaked out and got hit with shovels.
Yet you took down Cressida Vane, Danielle said. I knew her, you know.
You did? Jason asked.
Was she always massively overconfident?
That's what got her killed.
She was, actually, yes, Danielle said. It doesn't surprise me at all that it killed her in the end.
I've died 7 times today in your Mirage Arena, Jason said. Maybe 3 dozen this week. It feels real. The despair, the panic, the helplessness. It still comes every time.
Good, Danielle said. I want to see what Rufus saw.
I want to see you do the impossible. More importantly, I want the young members of my family to see it.
And if I fail miserably?
Then perhaps you'll think twice before trying to make my son question the fundamental makeup of our society.
Jason laughed. Yeah, sorry about that, he said sheepishly. I have a way of climbing up on my high horse.
My son has started asking questions that I'm not entirely sure I like.
Yes, you do, Jason said, with absolute confidence. She chuckled again.
Yes, I do, she acknowledged.
The door opened and Rick walked in. Like his sister, his skin was dark brown, his hair light brown. His build was more like Humphrey, tall and broad-shouldered. He led four more people behind him. Teams were not uncommon amongst adventurers, usually 3 to 6 members. Only in a relatively safe region like Greenstone was solitary operation commonplace. Rick's team had an archetypal distribution of roles, with a couple of resilient frontliners, some damage specialists, and a healer. Not every team could find a good healer. Even someone like Rufus had yet to find one. His experience with Anissa demonstrated that team dynamics were as much about the balance of personalities as the balance of powers. Rick shook Jason's hand and introduced his team members. It was obvious to Jason that his demand for a rematch wasn't rooted in pride, but the drive to improve himself that was common to the Geller clan. He had been surprised as anyone when Danielle set up Jason against his entire team. Only 3 of the 5 were Gellers, the other 2 a pair of twin elf sisters. Jason shook hands with each of them in turn. While Rick may not have been driven by pride, not everyone on his team was the same, and the largest member of the team squeezed Jason's hand brutally as he shook it. Ow, Jason said, cradling his hand after taking it back. Struth, mate. What was that for? Jonah, Rick scolded. What are you doing?
This idiot thinks he can take us 1-on-5, the big guy said.
Actually, that was my idea, Danielle said, drawing everyone's attention.
She had faded into the background so well as they were making introductions that Jason suspected it was some kind of aura trick. Just a subtle rise in her aura suddenly made her the center of attention. Jason had been working hard on his aura control, but realized he still had a long way to go. Most of the group looked at Danielle respectfully, but Jonah looked defiant.
Do you really think this guy is better than all 5 of us?
It isn't about being better, Danielle said. He may not have been training as long as you have, or used the carefully curated awakening stones you all did, but I've been watching him here in the Mirage Arena.
You have? Jason asked, looking disconcerted.
I have, she said. Jason might still be settling into his martial techniques, but he has completely learned a lesson that everyone here would do well to give more attention. So I set up this little match for everyone to see. I've queued up just the right scenario to make my point.
Rig the fight, you mean?
Jonah asked. Oh, good, Jason said, letting out a relieved breath. Just between us, I was a little worried.
Danielle chuckled. The scenario is a fugitive hunt. Rick, your team has 2 hours to find and capture or kill Jason. Jason, you need to avoid capture for the full duration or incapacitate Rick's team.
Not likely, Jonah muttered.
Did you have something to say, Jonah? Danielle asked.
I sure do, Jonah said, either not noticing or not caring about the warning in Danielle's voice. I'm going to show this little no-name weed what it means to fight a Geller.
Rick punched him on the arm. Shut up, idiot. He's been in here fighting Gellers all week.
Danielle gave Rick an approving smile. One more thing, she said. This scenario will be set during a monster surge.
Danielle walked into the viewing room, striding up onto the platform in front of the viewing window, with a crystal rod in her hand. The room went quiet. No one had the courage to still be talking when Danielle started speaking.
The Geller name is a good one to have, Danielle said. Each of you in this room either carries it or are the boon companions of those who do. It is a name that opens doors, garners respect. It is a name to be proud of.
She panned her gaze over the audience, Geller trainees, their companions, and a few of the instructors who trained them. She continued her speech.
I was just reminded, however, that pride can be a danger. We are not made great because our name is great. Our name is great because we make it so. Everyone who bears the Geller name has the responsibility to live up to it. We are born with this name, but it is not a gift. It is a stewardship, not just to the name itself, but to those who rely on it, who look up to it and respect it. The privilege and power that comes with our name is a covenant that we will use that power with decency and honor to protect and provide for those who do not share our privilege. It falls to each of us to ensure that when we pass on the Geller name, it is not lesser than we received it, but greater.
She waved the rod in her hand at the viewing window, which blinked to life. It showed a common scene from the Delta, muddy ground filled with tangled tree roots, the canopy overhead casting everything in shadow. Rick and his team trudged through the mud that sucked at their boots with every step.
As instructors, we find some lessons take longer to sink in than others,
Danielle said.
You are all filled with the realization of your new power. You feel strong, unbeatable even. It can make you disrespect the forces outside of yourself as determinants of success and failure.
She glanced back as the team struggled along the wet ground. Hidden roots and unexpected deep patches on mud made for stumbling progress. The thick foliage above them forced them to rely on a magic lamp for light. It was an expensive one that would float over them without occupying a hand, but it filled the space around them with the dancing shadows of the trees.
Your surroundings, Daniel picked up, can be a stronger weapon than the one in your hand. Monsters rarely spawn in training halls and fighting arenas. In most cases, you will be engaging them in their own environments. While you are watching, I want all of you to pay attention to this particular point. Who is using the environment and how?
Chapter 67. This is what it means to fight me. Jason moved comfortably through the marshy woods. His feet didn't sink into water or mud, and his eyes easily pierced the darkness. Clusters of scraggly trees and other obstacles were no bother. He could vanish into the ample shadows and appear on the far side. Despite being all an illusion, it felt completely real. The hot, heavy air, the tiny insects swarming around him. A small burst of aura projection sent them scattering. A thick strand of webbing launched itself out of a shadow, striking the spot where Jason had been moments before. It was not the first such miss, as Jason's eyes could dig out the trap weavers in the darkness. Even if they hit, the webs slid off. They could not adhere, either to his essence ability cloak or the armor underneath. Effect, resistant to adhesive substances and abilities with adhesive effects. The woods were filled with trap weavers, leaving behind a maze of sticky threads as they attempted to ensnare Jason. He flashed through the shadows, dagger planting in the head of a giant spider. It dropped to the ground as he continued strolling through the woods. In the viewing room, Danielle controlled the perspective of the viewing window with a rod in her hand. She used it to follow Rick and his team's journey through the dark, marshy woodlands. Henry Geller threw out his hand as he chanted a quick spell.
Firebolt!
Flame launched from Henry's fingers, missing the fleeting, shadowy figure to burn out as it hit a tree trunk. Hannah's arrow had come closer, but Jason's figure was gone before it too stuck harmlessly into a tree.
Henry!
Rick called out.
He jumps around too much, Henry said. It's like he's everywhere.
Henry wielded magic of wind and fire, and they had been tracking Jason by reading his scent on the air. They had caught glimpses of him, but only seen little more than shapes in the darkness. The group continued searching the murky woodland bog. Jonah was their bulwark, but his heavy armor and shield slowed him to a crawl. Rick was their other frontline fighter, and he was coping better. His armor wasn't as heavy, and his might essence gave him the strength to plow through the mud. His greatest problem was that his long, heavy sword was hard to swing among the trees. Rick and Jonah, along with Henry, were all members of the Geller family. The two remaining team members were the elf twins Hannah and Claire Adair, an archer and the team healer. As the healer, Claire was always the most important team member to protect. Her ability to cleanse Jason's afflictions made it doubly true. For this reason, she was in the most guarded part of the formation as they made their sluggish way through the marsh.
"What's that?" Jonah called from the front.
The others looked as he pointed out ahead. The trees grew closer together, and streamers of webbing, thick as an arm, were draped through them like party decorations. It wasn't any kind of pattern, but wild and scattered. It was thickly laid out, to the point of being hard to find a passage through.
"Trap weavers,"
Hannah said. They had already encountered several, most of which had been pinned to trees by her arrows.
"Trap weavers are careful," Rick said. "This doesn't look careful."
"I think Asano might have provoked them," Henry said. "This whole area is riddled with his scent."
"I don't think going through that is a good idea," Jonah said.
"We have to," Rick said.
"He hides, we chase, that's the game. If we refuse to go somewhere, he can just wait there and time us out."
"That's not a fair condition," Jonah said.
Hannah looked at him like he was an idiot.
"There's five of us," she said.
"I'm just saying,"
Jonah said, sullenly. "Hannah," Rick said, "your eyes are the best. Find us the clearest path." The webbing proved to be very widespread.
"How did he get trap weavers to do all this without getting caught by them?"
Claire wondered.
"He's tough to pin down," Rick said. "He may need shadows to teleport, but he can keep doing it over and over. In a place like this, he's a ghost."
As they headed into the web-strewn trees, they were plunged into shadow, the canopy above them low but thick. They were moving slower than ever as they picked their way through the webs.
"I don't like this," Henry said.
"We just need to get a good look at him,"
Hannah countered. Her bow was always at the ready. She was not worried about the obstructions and was prepared to fire from her short bow at a moment's notice.
"Can you burn through these webs?" Rick asked Henry.
"Trap weaver webs don't burn easily," Henry said.
"I'd blow through my mana and barely make a dent."
Around them was eerie quiet. Only the buzzing of insects accompanied the squelching of their feet in the mud. So a sudden new sound arrested their attention. The sound of feet pounding rapidly through the mud came from somewhere in the distance. The sound stopped for a moment. Then they heard panicked swearing, and the sound started again from a different direction. They heard the wet slap of something landing in the mud and a startled yelp.
"He's got monsters on him," Rick barked at the others. "Go!"
They surged over the marshy ground. Hannah had found them a path that was relatively solid, and even Jonah powered forwards in his heavy armor. What they found was an indentation in the mud. Rick looked around, peering at every shadow.
"Hannah," he asked.
When there was no response, he glanced back.
"Hannah?"
The whole team craned their necks, searching in every direction.
"She was right behind me," Claire said. "We were all running and..."
"Back the way we came,"
Rick said decisively, and so they went. What they found, to their horror, was Hannah's body, barely moved from where they had started running. Her throat was cut, and she dangled macabrely from thick strands of webbing like a puppet on strings.
"It's not real," Rick told Claire.
She looked at her sister with a hand over her mouth, eyes shocked wide. He put a supportive hand on her shoulder.
"It's just an illusion," he told her.
"We've been through this before.
Henry, do you have a scent?"
There was no answer, and they looked again. While they had been looking at Hannah's corpse, Henry had vanished. That left the two men in their heavy armor and the healer.
"How did he do that?" Jonah asked.
"He's going for the ones he can kill quick and quiet," Rick said. "The rest of us won't go out like that. Our armor and Claire's magic shield means he can't take us easily." Suddenly, blue light flared around Claire in the form of a bubble as objects struck it, three in quick succession. They were throwing knives, falling harmlessly into the mud after bouncing off the protective barrier.
"That way," Jonah called out,
but Rick grabbed his arm.
"He's baiting us," Rick said. "The way he baited the trap weavers into making all this mess. From now on, we go carefully." "How do we find him now?" Jonah asked. "Henry and Hannah were our spotters."
"We've been dancing to his tune the whole time," Rick said. "Time to change the music.
Use your shout." "Are you sure?" Jonah asked. You know what that'll do to the monsters.
He took out our spotters, Rick said. The best advantage we have now is a straight-up fight.
I don't think he's suddenly going to step out for that,
Jonah said. It's not us he'll be fighting, Rick said. He might be able to dodge a handful of trap weavers, but look at all these webs. That's more than a handful. If they all go berserk, he'll have a harder time dealing with them than we will.
Are you sure about that? Claire asked.
No, Rick said. I'm open to alternatives.
The others shook their heads.
All right, Rick said. Jonah shouts, then we fight off the monsters while we wait for them to flush him out.
Jonah nodded, then took a deep breath. Throwing back his head, he roared, a primal scream that blasted through the marsh like an explosion. As he fell silent, animal shrieks rose up in answer, echoing out what felt like miles. Rick grinned, hefting his sword in readiness.
Let's see how he... Crap!
Everything went dark as a thrown dagger shattered their floating lantern. Rick felt a sting on his arm, as did Jonah moments later. Light bloomed, illuminating the area from a glowing orb over Claire's raised hand. They looked around, but Jason was already gone.
Keep the orb up, Rick told Claire. I know it uses your mana, but not that much, and another lantern will be vulnerable.
She nodded, looking at the wounds on Jonah and Rick. Jason had found gaps in their armor while they couldn't see to defend against him, but he had barely drawn blood. They were minor cuts, but Rick had warned them early that it was all Jason required. Claire extended an arm towards Rick and chanted a spell.
Be made clean.
A glow of white gold light glowed out from under Jonah's armor, and a black smoke arose from the gap where Jason's knife had cut. She did the same with Jonah.
A poison and a curse each, Claire said. All gone now.
His hit-and-run attacks have done all the damage they can, Rick said. He can't quickly finish the rest of us, and now the trap weavers will flush him out.
We move carefully, fend off the weavers that come for us, and either find his corpse or make it.
Like this body?
A mocking voice asked. There was a lilting malevolence to it, like the speaker was slightly unhinged. They turned and saw Jason's shadowy figure behind the dangling corpse of Hannah, still strung up on webs. It was their first clear look at him, although clear wasn't exactly the word. He looked halfway made of shadows, his cloak of darkness wrapped around him. The dark flowing lines of his battle robe melded into the shadows and his face was shrouded in the darkness of the hood. Even with the light of Claire's orb, he was hard to see standing in front of them. Rick threw his massive sword. It spun through the air at Jason, but buried itself in Hannah's body as he moved further behind it for cover. Rick held out his hand, and the sword yanked itself from Hannah's corpse, flying back to Rick's hand. Standing behind the dangling macabre puppet that was the ravaged corpse of their companion, Jason's laughter was filled with sinister mirth.
So much for camaraderie, he said.
We're going to kill you, you sick prick,
Claire said to Jason, who laughed again. His response was to chant a spell, voice filled with malevolent relish.
As your life was mine to reap, your death is mine to harvest.
A dim red light shone from Hannah's body, which was quickly devoured by Jason. As it did, Hannah's skin grew dry, pulling tight over her skeleton as if years were passing in moments. Only a desiccated husk remained in her blood-stained clothes. Claire screamed out in anger, raising the wand in her hand. A bolt of white magical energy fired at Jason, tracking him through the air. He stepped closer to the corpse, which intercepted the attack. The withered body fell apart, tumbling piecemeal to the ground. Claire watched in horror as her sister's body crumbled into dried-up chunks, splattering into the mud. When she looked up for the one responsible, Jason was already gone.
You should be careful,
his voice mocked them, first from one direction, then another.
I thought I had the spiders riled up, but you really went and did it.
Jason's voice was playful and cruel as he taunted them. Each time he spoke, it came from a new direction.
My friends are coming for you, he said.
You might want to get out of these webs.
His laughter rang through the trees.
Rick?
Jonah asked.
He's not wrong about the webs, Rick said. Slow and careful. Claire in the middle, and I'll bring up the rear.
I'm going to kill the evil weasel,
Claire said.
Hannah's fine, Rick said. She's already awake, back in the control room.
I hope she stabs him while he's still in here.
Claire said. Jonah yelled out, standing awkwardly in place. He had stumbled into a near-invisible web. At the same time, a thick strand of webbing launched out of the shadows to drag Rick stumbling back. They were an experienced team who had handled trap weavers in real life, so they moved quickly into action. Claire's wand, glowing at the tip, cut Jonah free of the web, and she used it like a knife. Rick planted his feet, and even with the mushy ground underfoot, his immense strength arrested the force dragging him. He gripped the web and yanked hard, yanking a huge spider off a tree to sail through the air towards him. Swinging his huge sword in one hand, he cut the monster in half as it tumbled through the air, then scraped the sticky web off his hand with the blade. Jonah sloshed back through the mud, putting up his huge shield as the three of them backed away. Multiple strands of web shot at it, but slid off as if it were greased in oil. Spiders were crawling all over the trees around them now, leaping from one to the other.
"How are there so many?" Claire asked, firing off bolts from her wand.
With each bolt, a spider fell, but the tree-hopping creatures were outpacing their careful withdrawal. Surrounding them, the spiders were able to fire webbing from the sides where Jonah couldn't cover, but it accomplished little. Claire ignored the webs, her barrier offering even less purchase than Jonah's shield. Rick danced around as if he wasn't shin-deep in mud, his huge sword flashing out, quick and deadly. One of Rick's trump cards was an essence ability that temporarily ramped up his speed and power, and he put it to good use. His huge sword was incredibly heavy, but he waved it like a baton, intercepting webs and slashing through spiders. The blade of his sword was glowing red hot and had burst into flame, cutting through webs and spiders alike with a searing hiss. He had been saving his abilities for a crucial moment, but there was an army of spiders bearing down on them.
"This way!"
Jonah shouted, wading into thigh-deep water.
"They don't swim!"
It was a wide patch of water, common enough in the marsh, but it had one advantage. No trees were rising out of it. Following Jonah let them escape the trap weaver onslaught. The lack of trees gave the monsters no place to jump to, and the absence of canopy meant no shadows for Jason to jump out of. Even reaching the middle of the water, it had never gone deeper than Claire's waist.
"Now we wait," Rick said. "Without us, Jason becomes the only food on the market. He can't avoid them all, riled up like they are."
The three waited, back to back, as they watched the edge of the trees for movement. The glowing orb floated over them, light shining off the water. The screeching sounds of trap weavers came from all around. The water stilled around them when they stopped moving. Eventually, the trap weavers calmed, their shrieks diminishing down until they finally stopped.
"Do you think they got him?" Claire asked.
"They had to, right?"
Jonah said.
"We have to go check," Rick said. "I think the loudest concentration of screeching came from over..." "Did anyone else feel that?"
"I can feel it crawling on my boots," Jonah said. "There's something in the water."
"Out of the water,"
Rick commanded, pointing in a direction. Even as he did, the water around them started roiling like a boiling soup. The barrier around Claire flashed in staccato rhythm. Jonah grimaced and Jonah let out a painful grunt.
"What is that?" Claire asked, pushing down panic. "It keeps attacking my shield. It's going to eat through all my mana."
"Just keep moving," Rick yelled.
Their resolve showed as they didn't slow their pace, even as something attacked them from under the water. Claire's shield absorbed attacks at the cost of mana, regardless of the strength of the attack. Rapid, weak attacks were the shield's weakness, and something was attacking it in swarms under the water. Unhappily, she let the shield drop before her mana was emptied out, immediately feeling the sting as something started biting into her legs. Their attackers were revealed to be leeches as the creatures climbed high enough up their bodies to rise above the water. The leeches crawled over them in search of vulnerable flesh. Claire fought through the pain to chant spell after spell, cleansing afflictions and healing through bleeds. The others had dropped their weapons to have their hands free, Jonah yanking the shield off his arm. They tugged off leeches with both hands and tossed them away, the leeches taking gobbets of flesh with them. The adventurers' efforts made little headway with the swarming leeches.
"My spells can't keep up!" Claire yelled.
The leeches constantly inflicted bleeds and afflictions faster than she could chant. The afflictions slowly but surely stacked up while the bleeds soaked up the healing. Their skin started to blacken around the leech bites, all the while they kept making for the shoreline, finally struggling out of the water. Suddenly Jason was there, a lunging kick sending Claire splashing back into the water. Jonah threw a gauntleted fist, but Jason danced lightly away on the surface of the water. Claire sat up, spluttering, only for Jason to kick her in the teeth in passing, sending her back down. He pointed at Rick.
Your fate is to suffer.
Rick had his hand extended out in the direction of the water. His huge sword was spinning through the air, throwing off droplets of water as it flew past Jason and into Rick's hand. Jonah held his own hand out, and an iron spear appeared in it. Both men drew their weapons. They struck home with accuracy, but kept going. Jason's cloak suddenly empty. After being dragged through the air, the cloak disappeared, and Jonah watched his spear splash uselessly into the water. Rick's sword stopped in the air and flew back to his hand.
What was that?
Jonah asked, looking around for Jason as he yanked off leeches.
I thought he could only teleport through shadows.
I don't know, Rick said, likewise yanking off leeches.
My cloak is a shadow, Jason said, walking out of the trees well out of melee range.
His cloak was no longer around him, and they could see his face. His eyes were wide and his mouth was twisted in a deranged smirk. He looked hungry for something that definitely shouldn't be food. The cloak formed around him once more, hiding his face and its disturbing grin.
Finally ready for a fair fight?
Jonah asked, another spear appearing in his hand.
Two against one is hardly fair, Jason said.
You mean three?
Jonah said. Rick was quicker on the uptake, looking to the water behind them. Claire's body floated on the surface with the awkward stillness of death, leeches swarming over it.
She focused her healing on us, Rick said bitterly, as they looked at her corpse, robbed of dignity and death.
He turned to spit invective at Jason, but he had vanished again while they were transfixed by the fate of their healer.
I'm going to rip your head off,
Jonah screamed into the air.
Are you sure?
Jason's voice came from the trees, lilting and off-kilter.
Your healer is gone.
His voice came from another direction.
All I have to do now is wait,
he said from a new direction again. Rick grimaced, knowing Jason was right. They had managed to tear off most of the leeches, which couldn't move through the mud like they could in the water. But the damage was done. Standing around with no recourse, he could do nothing, even as he collapsed to the ground. That left only Jonah. Jonah had the greatest fortitude of the team. His resilience and heightened resistances let him last well beyond his comrades. But he could do no more than Rick. He screamed rage into the shadowy woods, then spotted Jason emerge once again at a distance. He threw his spear, expecting Jason to vanish into the darkness again. Instead, Jason made no move to avoid it, and the spear impaled him, low and to the side of his torso. He staggered back several steps before righting himself, not making a sound. Jason regained his balance, then pulled the spear from his body, hand over hand, as Jonah watched. Holding the spear in one hand, Jason pushed the hood of his cloak back with the other, revealing his face. He took the spear and slowly ran his tongue along the shaft as Jonah watched in shock. Jason tossed the spear aside, eyes wide, as his lips, tainted with his own blood, took on a maniacal grin.
I taste good,
Jason said, looking absently at the blood on his hands. Then he looked up at Jonah.
I wonder how yours will taste.
You aren't touching my blood, you crazy freak!
Are you sure?
Jason asked, then chanted out a spell.
Your blood is not yours to keep, but mine on which to feast.
Red life force started shining out of Jonah's body, streaks of dark colors reflecting the afflictions he was suffering. Red light streamed away through the air towards Jason. Jason threw his arms back, pushing his head forwards with a wild and hungry grin. The life force vanished into his face as he moaned with pleasure.
You're seriously messed up,
Jonah said, as his remaining life force returned to his body. He could barely stand now, blackened veins visible under his skin.
You're not looking so good, Jonah, Jason said. Don't worry, I can clear that right up.
He raised his hand like a weapon.
Feed me your sins.
The red light appeared again from within Jonah, but this time the tainted colors poured out into Jason, leaving the dim light of Jonah's life force clean.
Refreshing, Jason said, as if Jonah's affliction were a cup of iced tea.
The curse and poison were cleansed, but the bleeding continued, and Jonah was too far gone to rally.
You said you would show me what it means to fight a Geller, Jason said, walking slowly forward.
But I've fought Gellers, Jonah, and I'm not sure you live up to the name.
Jason stepped onto the water, walking past Jonah to Claire's body. Jonah could barely keep to his feet as he turned to face Jason, almost stumbling into the mud. He watched Jason, standing over Claire's body, grip the elf's long blonde hair, stained dark by muddy water and her own blood. He pulled her up out of the water.
Look at your friends, Jonah. You were meant to protect them, but they died helpless and agonizing deaths.
Like you will. I've seen what it means to fight a Geller, Jonah. This is what it is to fight me.
He let Claire drop back into the water.
Just end this, you sick lunatic,
Jonah said, glaring defiance. Jason walked casually up to Jonah, who could barely stand, let alone fight back. Jason walked around him, looking him over like a slab of meat in a butcher shop. Jonah lacked the strength to turn and face him again. Jason shoved him in the back, and Jonah toppled into the mud. Jason stepped forward, pushing down Jonah's head with his foot.
I've never seen anyone drown in mud before, Jason said.
In the viewing room, the window went dark as Jonah's feeble struggling came to a stop. In the aftermath, there was silence. Chapter 68. Good News for Clive. The common room of Jason's inn was a sprawling, luxurious space, with dining area, bar, and lounge. Jason was in the lounge area with Rick Geller, who had sought him out in the early hours, eager to discuss their fight. Jason was quickly realizing that Rick was obsessively dedicated to training, even compared to other Gellers. To Jason's surprise, he bore no animosity against Jason for the loss or wariness over his tactics. Instead, he was excited to encounter a fighting style unlike any he'd encountered before.
It was incredible, Rick said. Sometimes people can get lax in the Mirage Chamber because it isn't real. The way you got in our heads, though, you had me making rush decisions, panicking. I've watched the recording at least a half dozen times, and I just keep screaming at myself to do something different.
There's a recording? Jason asked.
There certainly is, Rick said. It's all from our perspective, so you're barely in it until the end. You're always this crazy threat lingering just out of sight. That crazy laugh, that creeps me out. I really felt like you'd lost it.
A lot of guys ignore the laugh, Jason said, and that's about standards.
Hannah thinks you're amazing.
Isn't she the one I ambushed, cut her throat, and strung her up to use as a shield? Jason said uncertainly.
She saw most of it from the control room, Rick said. She had copies of the recording made, and she's been showing them off to people.
Why would she do that?
Hannah's very spirited, Rick said. Always ready to go, ready to try anything. She'll take almost anything, good or bad, as an experience worth having. She's kind of amazing.
Oh, Jason said, arching his eyebrows meaningfully.
Not like that, Rick said.
Jason shook his head. It wasn't that long since he was a teenager himself, but it had been a hard exit, relationship-wise.
Don't let it just sit there, Jason said. Tell her and find out one way or the other. Trust a guy who didn't for far too long.
The others are mixed in their reactions, Rick said, forcibly steering the topic in a new direction.
Henry is a little scared of you, I think. Claire is ready to stake you out and leave you to the marsh ants. More for what you did to her sister than her, but she didn't like those leeches. Were you actually controlling them?
That's my familiar, Colin, Jason said.
Colin? Wait, your familiar is a swarm of leeches.
That's right.
Swarm-type familiars are really rare, Rick said. I've seen more dragon and phoenix familiars. The only other swarm type I've seen is a gold ranker back in my home city. He has these fire hornets that suicide attack to inflict a burning condition.
and when they kill something, a bunch more hornets burst out of it.
Nasty, Jason said.
How did Jonah take how our fight turned out?
Jonah can be obnoxious and strong-willed, even to his own detriment.
I won't hold that against him, Jason said. I've been guilty of that more than once myself.
Well, you've earned his respect, Rick said.
Seriously? Jason asked.
How does that work?
Jonah can be prideful and quick to look down on people, Rick said. He respects strength, though. He doesn't care if you're a king or a commoner. Show him you're capable, and you have his respect. He just needs to stop making snap judgments about people before he knows what he's talking about.
Also something I've been guilty of.
I think you might have startled Humphrey quite badly, though, Rick said. I don't think he realized you had that in you.
I'm not sure I did either, Jason said.
I think that might have been bubbling up for a while. I'm really surprised you don't have more of a burn him, he's a witch attitude. You're not actually some kind of bloodthirsty lunatic, right?
Of course not, Jason said. It was just a persona. I might have got carried away with it a bit, though.
I felt so free afterwards, like I finally started pushing back on all the pressures I've been feeling.
Still, you really aren't freaked out.
You don't know a lot of adventurers, do you?
I know a few.
Once you know more, you'll understand. As long as the Adventure Society isn't sending people to hunt you down, anything is on the table. Fear, misery, despair. If those are your weapons, use them. If you have them and you don't use them, you're an idiot. Of course, that's a generalization. Everyone has their own opinion.
Humphrey?
Humphrey. I should talk to him, Jason said. I don't have enough friends to start scaring them off.
In my experience, it's best to just leave him be, Rick said. He'll work things through and then come find you.
All right. Thanks, Jason said.
So when are we having a rematch?
Jason went downstairs to the common room. He was dressed in cool and comfortable clothes, loose tan pants, colorful shirts, and sandals. He was about to set off on a contract, but there was a decent travel time, and he could change clothes in little more than an instant. He might as well travel comfortably.
Mr. Asano!
Clive Standish stood up from where he had been quietly sitting in the common room, under the baleful eye of Madame Landry.
Jason is fine, Jason said, as he walked past Clive and out the door.
The sun had yet to rise, the pre-dawn light washing out all the colour from the world. Jason observed the similarity to how things looked with his ability to see through the dark. Clive followed Jason outside and down the street.
Mr. Asano. Jason. This was the agreed-upon time for our meeting.
I've got some good news for you, Clive, Jason said, walking down the street.
Our meeting is going to be extra long.
Why is that?
Clive asked warily as he followed along.
I have a contract, Jason said. Probably take me a few days. We'll have a nice, long meeting on the way.
On the way where?
There are some villages deep in the delta, Jason said. They're being menaced by something called a mangrove snatcher.
A large lizard-type creature, Clive said. It attacks by ambush after hiding in waterways, or burrowing itself into mud or wet earth. Unusual for a monster prone to such tactics, it doesn't have the ability to hide its own aura. That makes it bad at hunting animals, which are sensitive to auras.
So it goes after people?
It does, Clive said. Any essence user who has reached iron rank will sense its aura, making it a minimal threat to adventurers. To ordinary people, on the other hand, it can be quite the danger.
You know your stuff, Jason said. You've dealt with them before?
Oh, goodness no, Clive said. I may ostensibly be a member of the Adventure Society, but I'm not an active one.
Well, you are this week.
What?
You're coming with me, Jason said.
No,
Clive said.
No, I'm not.
Jason pulled out a folded piece of paper from his pocket and handed it to Clive, who read it as they walked.
This is the contract, Clive said. What does that have to do with me?
Four different villagers in the area sent word that the mangrove snatcher came right into the village. Aggressive little prick, apparently. The messengers all came in overnight and the contract was assigned to me. I was told to head out at first light. He waved an arm at the sky.
And here we are, Jason said. First light.
I realize that being assigned a contract preempts our appointment, Clive said, but it does not mean that I'm going to participate.
You might want to take another look at the contract, Jason said.
down the bottom. Clive looked over the contract again.
"It's been amended," he read, disbelievingly. "It's been assigned to me as well."
"I don't know if you're aware," Jason said, "but the new branch director has kind of a thing about Adventure Society members who don't actually go on adventures."
"You did this."
"Well, I knew we had that meeting."
"Did I do something to offend you, Mr. Asano?"
"Just call me Jason."
"What I call you isn't the issue."
Jason stopped walking, turning to face Clive. "Clive. Can I call you Clive?" "Clive, do you know what an outworlder is?"
"I do," Clive said. "Astral magic is actually my specialty."
"I know a little astral magic," Jason said. "Found this school book when I first..." "That doesn't matter. Clive, I'm an outworlder. I was keeping that under my hat, but too many people know now for it to be a real secret." Clive goggled at Jason.
"I have so many questions," he said.
"We'll get to that," Jason said. "The thing is, I arrived in this world in less than ideal circumstances. Everything was strange, people were trying to kill me, and I had no idea where I was or what was going on. So I kind of have a thing about getting ambushed. And then comes you, asking questions, knowing who I am and where to find me. I don't like it, Clive."
"I did introduce myself."
"Clive, have you heard of lying?"
"Of the concept of lying?"
"Yes."
"Of course I have," Clive said.
"There you go." Clive shook his head.
"Having a conversation with you is like wrestling an eel," Clive said.
"When did you ever wrestle an eel?" Jason said skeptically.
"I grew up on an eel farm, out on the Delta."
"Really?" Jason said, looking at Clive with new respect. "It must have been a lot of work to get from there to here."
"I had some good fortune.
My friend's grandfather says the great adventurers are the ones who turn luck into fortune."
"Is your friend's grandfather someone worth listening to?"
"Never met the man, so I'm not sure," Jason said. "He runs a school in Vitesse. I haven't had a chance to visit yet."
"Wait, are you talking about Rufus Remore's grandfather?"
"Well, best get going," Jason said, setting off again.
"Wait," Clive said. "We need to go to the Magic Society first. If I'm going to be gone for several days, I need to make arrangements for my other duties. Also, we can pick up some transport. I'm not riding a Heidel. I hate those things."
That got Jason's attention.
"Me too," Jason said.
"What kind of transport are you talking about?"
"How has no one told me about these?" Jason called out joyously.
They were skimming over the water in an airboat. Instead of a fan at the back, there was a vertical metal ring, around which had been engraved a magical diagram. Propulsion came from air sucked in through the front of the ring and propelled from the rear with great force. Sitting in front of it, the occupants were bombarded by the loud air rushing in. At the front of the boat was Clive's familiar, a rune tortoise named Onslow. His head was jutting forwards like a dog, with its head out a car window. They left the city from a different gate than Jason had previously, as it gave them better access to the waterways of the Delta. Although verdant and filled with wetlands, only some parts were completely navigable by boat. Clive piloted the airboat by holding his hand over a glowing blue cube. With tiny hand gestures, he could speed up, slow down, or turn the boat. He drove it with confidence, sending them careening over the water. Occasionally, they would need to pass through one of the artificial embankment roads that divided up the Delta. There were many bridges built into them, so as to not obstruct the waterways. The airboat was just short enough to pass under them, with a wide margin on either side. There were handles on either side of Jason's padded seat, on which he kept a white-knuckle grip each time Clive sent the boat shooting through the tiny space under a bridge.
"Can you teach me to drive one of these things?" Jason asked.
They had to talk loudly to be heard over the rushing air, almost at a shout.
"You can only drive these if you have the right essence ability," Clive yelled back at Jason. "It usually comes from the magic essence. The same power lets you use magical weapons like wands."
Jason was learning there was a lot more to the gangly scholar than he had initially presumed. Gone were the two large robes, replaced with more practical wear for the Delta, with sturdy-looking pants, shirts, and vest. Jason spotted a bracelet on Clive's wrist, identical to the one on his own. It was a cord looped through small blue stones, each with a hole in the middle.
"Item, Oasis bracelet, iron rank, uncommon. A bracelet that draws on the power of water quintessence to bestow the blessings of a personal oasis. Accessory, bracelet."
Effect. When a water quintessence gem is set into the bracelet, it keeps the wearer cool and refreshed. Effect. Reduces incoming fire and heat damage. This effect accelerates consumption of the water quintessence gem. There was also what looked like an ordinary stick sheathed against Clive's thigh. Jason realized it must be a magic wand.
I was expecting you to fight me more on coming out here, Jason called out.
When I have an outworlder's captive attention? Clive asked.
There's no way I'd pass that up. As you said, we can have a nice long meeting on the way. I have so many questions.
I did say that, didn't I? All right, Clive, ask away.
They arrived at the first village, where there were signs of the monster attacking. The villagers had reacted quickly, barricading themselves in their homes. There were marks of the monster trying to break in, but it failed to breach the thick mud-brick walls. The villagers told them they had been attacked every day while they waited for their messengers to reach Greenstone. Jason told them to keep themselves locked away while they checked on the other villagers. He and Clive got back in their airboat and took off again. As they travelled, Clive continued his interrogation of Jason.
You killed Landomir Vane?
And his mum, Jason said. Did you know them?
I knew him.
He wasn't a friend, was he?
No, Clive said. The whole family was reclusive. I only knew him at all because we specialized in the same field of magic.
Jason looked up and around.
Hey, we're almost at the next village.
You know this area?
Clive asked.
No, one of my outworlder abilities is a map only I can see. Places only appear on it when I get close, though.
Fascinating, Clive said.
Have you tested the effects of going to a high place with superior sight lines?
I haven't, Jason said. That's a good idea.
This is why you need to let me study you.
Definitely not, Jason said. I get enough of that from Farah.
Who?
A friend of mine. She's Magic Society too. I'll introduce you.
Chapter 69 Dumpling Soup. There was a small jetty from which they could see the village. There were several dinghies tied up, one of which had been sunk in the shallow water. A streak of dried blood was on the part jutting above the waterline.
Looks like someone's hurt,
Clive said as he tied the airboat to the jetty.
I hope so.
You hope someone's hurt?
You can fix hurt. Can't fix dead.